of the Ahlbayt alayhi wasalam have not said such a thing, because it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
But for other narrations, our intellect neither rejects that nor accept that, like crying of the heavens.
It's better to say that the ordinary intellect of the human is incapable of understanding
them. But does not reject that. It says that it might happen. So for those cases, we need to check the narrations. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, for most of the cases that you mentioned, we have some narration in this regard.
But what is important about the day of Ashura is that so many stories have been given by the previous generations of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, by Imam Ali, Prophet Muhammad, and before that in so many documents. Recently I saw a documentary talking about Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, even in the older scriptures, referring to some of the references that on the day of Ashura, coinciding with such and such day according to Judaism or Christianity, some strange things would happen. So it shows the very specific, specific status and the place of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and that specific day. So in this way, we can understand them. That's all right. Thank you very much, Shaykh. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
Inshallah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us the chance of reaching such a spiritual perfection to understand such things. And in fact, to clean our eyes in order to see such things with our eye of the heart and eye of the soul, inshallah, to understand them perfectly, inshallah. Thank you much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله الحسين
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Yemeni men, ominous shadows.
Part 1.
The war in Yemen was in fact a combination of three battles. Everyone knows about the first war, the resistance by the Ansarullah against the Saudi invasion and the forces supported by Mohammed bin Salman. The second war is a conflict between the Houthis and the Al-Qaeda militants who are supported by Riyadh to make Yemen insecure and crush the Houthis who are Zaydi Shias. But we've heard less often about Yemen's third war. On April 27, 2017, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, Mohammed bin Salman's crony, who claims to be Yemen's president, deposed Idarus Qasim Abdul Aziz Al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, the capital of former South Yemen. The reason for his dismissal was the vast relationship between Zubaydi and a tiny nation on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf. The newly established United Arab Emirates. After the dismissal, a large crowd of Zubaydi supporters took to the streets. The supporters were mobilized by the UAE. Hadi was informed through Saudi agents that the United Arab Emirates was behind all of this. It wasn't the first time that Hadi and bin Salman were informed of the UAE's spontaneous measures. Last winter, Hadi, who usually resided in Saudi Arabia, decided to visit Aden, that was the largest city controlled by the Saudi-backed militants. When Hadi's plane approached the airport in Yemen, as a rule of thumb, it requested to land, but the airport in Yemen didn't allow the plane to land. So the plane had to land kilometers away on the island of Socotra. Hadi was enraged. He fired the director of the airport and ordered the forces under his command to besiege the airport. The UAE-backed forces opened fire at Hadi's forces at the airport. So the rift that everyone was already aware of opened wider. The rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia,
بين الإمارات والسعودية.
Bin Salman had sensed the danger and initially decided to act as the big brother and impartial mediator to forge reconciliation between Hadi and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, who's also the UAE's deputy commander-in-chief, Bin Zayed. 2 weeks later, Hadi left for Abu Dhabi, but talks took only 10 minutes. Bin Zayed reminded Hadi that the UAE has paid a lot of money to liberate Yemen. And Hadi told Bin Zayed that the UAE acts like an occupying power in Yemen, not a country that's deployed forces to liberate it. Hadi decided to fire the UAE cronies in his government, which itself was designated by Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman was supposed to teach the UAE a lesson and force them to support Saudi policies and stop going their own way. Finally, on April 27, 2017, Bin Salman gave Hadi the green light to punish the UAE. Adarus Qasim al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, and Hani Ali bin Breik, one of the ministers of Hadi's cabinet, were fired. The UAE reacted quickly. A massive protest in Aden. This time, the groups in Aden sought independence in South Yemen. For decades, Yemen had been divided into two northern and southern parts. North Yemen, whose capital was Sana'a, gained independence from the Ottoman Empire in the last year of the First World War in 1918. but South Yemen remained under British control for several decades later. Aden, the capital of South Yemen, was an important port for UK colonial ships in West and South Asia for decades. In 1969, South Yemen became independent. Twenty-one years later, in 1990, South Yemen became united with North Yemen. 30 years later, the unity was about to collapse due to the UAE's meddlesome policies. After the war in Yemen, Houthi forces backed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia managed to occupy parts of what was called South Yemen in the past. North Yemen was still in control of Ansarullah forces, so South Yemen had turned into the only shelter for the Saudi-backed rebels. After the independence-seeking move in South Yemen, the bastion would be lost. Hadi was concerned. Bin Salman was even more concerned. Hadi's government was a Bin Salman puppet and was supported by the U.S. ambassador. After the differences intensified, Bin Salman realized that the UAE's offensive move wasn't against Hadi, but him. The UAE challenged Hadi's rule over Aden, even though it knew Bin Salman backed him. It was a proclamation of war against Bin Salman.
اتخذ محمد بن سلمان الخطوة التالية إذ أعلنها جهارا بأنه يقف
Bin Salman took the next step. He openly announced that he supports all decisions, measures, and arrangements by the Hadi government to restore security in Yemen. It means that Saudi Arabia allowed Hadi to crush the militants in South Yemen who were backed by the UAE. The STC, or the Southern Transitional Council, is a Yemeni group that wants to see South Yemen as an independent country in the international community. It meant that Hadi would lose his only base and Bin Salman's war in Yemen would practically end in failure. The STC was formed on the 14th of May, 2017. Its leader was Idrus al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, who had just been deposed by Hadi. After receiving the thumbs up from Bin Salman, Hadi immediately announced that the council was illegal, but the STC isn't just a political group. Its military branch, called the Security Belt Forces, was formed, a 15,000-strong militia group entirely funded by the United Arab Emirates. In January 2018, Zubaydi announced that the process of deposing Hadi and Aden had started. Now, a new front has opened for MBS. On January 28th, all administrative buildings of Hadi's government in Aden were captured. The SDC controlled the city. The spring in 2018 started while the Emiratis made another new move. Babu Mandab. It means the gate of wailing. The myth has it that once a battle took place in the region and the fugitives who passed from the strait cried over those who were killed, but some others say that the name has its roots in the slavery era when the strait was a crossing point for the ships that transferred slaves from Africa. So the name the Strait of Wailing was chosen because of the crying of the slaves. Beyond the world of mythology, the situation hasn't changed that much. Wailing can still be heard from the strait. This is part of Africa called the Horn of Africa. After Eritrea split from Ethiopia, it was a hot spot for long battles for several decades. On the other side of the strait, Yemen is located, another hot spot for war. But the emergence of a new economic power changed the equation. China has been in the region for a while, and in order to get closer to the strait, it has signed trade contracts with Ethiopia near the strait. China has established a special economic zone in Ethiopia. It manufactures electrical appliances, construction material, agricultural machinery, steel, and other metals in the zone. Even the small country near the strait, namely Djibouti, signed a contract with China. Now, based on that contract, China established a naval base near Djibouti. The base fights sea pirates. The beginning of the threat to the Western interests in Bab el-Mandab Strait. After China came to the region, everyone got worried. Now, the Persian Gulf Arab states consider control over the strait a major part of security in their region. Soon, Turks, Japanese, and Americans showed up for trade and gaining a foothold on the African side of the strait. Let's take a look at the strait once again. Sea transportation is the most important way of transit for goods and energy all across the world. If the strait is shut, the route becomes several times longer and the costs will also increase. As you can see, all ways lead to this strait. So, many countries showed up one after the other to invest on the African side. World economy was going through transformation. Economies like China, India, and Brazil were now on the list of top 10 countries with the highest GDP. These countries have young populations. The old rich countries, except for the U.S., are suffering from aging crisis. Their populations are getting older. It means the balance will gradually tip in favor of consumption and against production. Cheap labor force and new markets are the dream of the new capitalist system. In recent years, the economic growth of the countries to the south of Bab el-Mandab Strait boosted because of the presence of foreign investors. Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Eritrea experienced an economic growth of 5 to 9%. The growth did not exist in these countries during the past years. Something new was happening. Arab countries also showed up. From 2000, the investment of Arabs started in the Horn of Africa. It was mainly in Sudan and Ethiopia that reached $13 billion as of 2017. That was a time when the war in Yemen started with Saudi, U.S., and UAE meddlesome policies. The problem in the north of the strait should have been resolved. Let's review the developments in the strait in recent years. A civil war broke out in Somalia, Eritrea split from Ethiopia, Sudan was divided into northern and southern parts, and now it was Yemen's turn. All of these developments took place near the vital strait, yes, reviving the issue of North and South Yemen, or the Southern Transitional Council, was supported by the UAE. It didn't stop with supporting the secessionist group and personally got involved. This is Socotra Island, Yemen's large and strategic island in the Indian Ocean, en route to Bab al-Mandab. Any country that takes control of the island will practically control one of the most strategic routes in the world with heavy traffic. The Asma Island belongs to Yemen, but it's been abandoned for a while because of the war. Only a UAE military unit stays on the island. In the 2015 tempest, the island was badly damaged. The island's infrastructure was demolished. The war in mainland Yemen was ongoing, and no group could help the island. The Emiratis took advantage of the situation. UAE aid and rescue forces were the first ones to arrive on the island. Afterwards, the military forces showed up. They had come to train the militia group affiliated with them on Socotra. It was the same strategy they devised for Aden and South Yemen. Hence, the UAE gained a foothold in the strategic island. Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi's vice president, Ahmed Obeid Ben Dagher, announced the occupation of Socotra port and airport by the United Arab Emirates was a violation of Yemen's national sovereignty. The UAE knew that it has the upper hand. In secret meetings with the U.S. and Zionist officials, it agreed to normalize ties with the occupying regime. For the UAE, the normalization would help it get closer to Washington, so it believed that in the developments in Yemen, it would have the upper hand. The UAE handed Socotra over to the STC, but considering the relations between Zionist regime and the UAE and the STC, we could say that South Yemen and Socotra were in the occupying regime's clutches. To some extent, things went as the UAE had planned. Donald Trump didn't want to disturb the Abu Dhabi-Tel Aviv normalization, so he didn't side with Israel, and he only said the two sides need to reduce tensions. The young Saudi ruler now faced a bitter reality. He cannot even control his ally, namely the tiny nation of the UAE. In fact, the UAE had entered the Yemen war with the goal of economic development. The carnage of people in Yemen, famine, disease, hunger, and ruining all welfare indices were the costs that the Yemenis had to pay so the UAE could progress. But the loser of the game was Bin Salman. He never realized that he was ditched by his closest ally in the region. In 2019, when Hadi's forces moved to Aden for a massive attack, UAE fighter jets launched a blitzkrieg on Hadi forces on August 29, 2019. It was a complicated situation. For the Houthis and Ansarullah, the UAE was like Saudi Arabia as they both targeted civilians. But at the same time, the Emiratis moved against Hadi, who was appointed by Riyadh. The situation put bin Salman in a tough spot. On April 26, 2020, the situation became more complicated for Hadi and bin Salman. The STC claimed autonomy.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The New York laws struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. We now present you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, U.S. Supreme Court Overturns New York Handgun Law in Bitter Blow to Gun Control Push. The U.S. Supreme Court has opened the door for almost all law-abiding Americans to carry concealed and loaded handguns in public, after a conservative majority struck down a New York law that placed strict restrictions on firearms outside of the home. The governor of New York, a Democrat, said the ruling was not just reckless, it's reprehensible. Pointing to recent mass shooting incidents in New York and Texas, a leading progressive group called the ruling shameful and outrageous. President Joe Biden said this ruling contradicts both common sense and the Constitution and should deeply trouble us all. On the left, outrage is growing over the court's rightward march. Recently, the court handed down a ruling which attacked the separation of church and state. As soon as Friday, 24th of June, it is expected to undermine or remove the right to abortion, guaranteed since 1973, and to reduce the federal government's ability to cut emissions contributing to the climate crisis. The New York law struck down on Thursday, 23rd of June, required anyone wanting to carry a handgun in public to prove that they had a proper cause to do so. The decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen renders the law an unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment right to bear arms. In his ruling, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "Apart from a few late 19th century outlier jurisdictions, American governments simply have not broadly prohibited the public carry of commonly used firearms for personal defense. Nor have they generally required law-abiding, responsible citizens to demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community to carry arms in public. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "The New York law also violated the 14th Amendment, which made Second Amendment rights applicable to the states." President Biden pointed to the longevity of the New York gun laws and to past Supreme Court acceptance of the need to regulate gun ownership. President Biden said since 1911, the state of New York has required individuals who would like to carry a concealed weapon in public to show a need to do so for the purpose of self-defense and to require a license. More than a century later, the United States Supreme Court has chosen to strike down New York's long-established authority to protect its citizens. President Biden added, "As the late conservative Justice Antonin Scalia recognized, the Second Amendment is not absolute. For centuries, states have regulated who may purchase or possess weapons, the types of weapons they may use, and the places they may carry those weapons. The courts have upheld these regulations." President Biden noted, "I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Lives are on the line. The ruling has profound implications for the safety and conduct of up to 83 million people in New York and seven other states plus Washington, D.C., with similar proper cause laws. They include heavily populated states such as California and New Jersey, which account for roughly 3 out of every 4 Americans. Just weeks ago, an 18-year-old carrying a legally bought assault rifle shot and killed 10 people in a racist attack on a supermarket in a majority black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York. Just 10 days later, another 18-year-old teenager broke into an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, and killed 19 children and 2 adults before being shot dead by law enforcement. Democratic and Republican senators have since agreed a framework for gun reform. On Thursday, 23rd of June, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said the proposals did not lay one finger on the Second Amendment and would make the country safer. But any gun legislation inevitably faces strong headwinds, with the potential to blow all the way to the court. McConnell helped pack with conservatives. In his dissent to the New York ruling, Chief Justice Stephen Breyer, a liberal justice soon to retire, wrote, "In 2020, 45,222 Americans were killed by firearms. Since the start of this year, there have been 277 reported mass shooting incidents, an average of more than one per day." Justice Stephen Breyer said, "Gun violence has now surpassed motor vehicle crashes as the leading cause of death among children and adolescents. Many states have tried to address some of the dangers of gun violence just described by passing laws that limit, in various ways, who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds." Justice Stephen Breyer added, "The court today severely burdens states' efforts to do so." Rana Epting, executive director of the progressive group Move On, lamented a shameful and outrageous decision, adding, "The conservative-packed Supreme Court, in concert with Republicans in Congress, is ensuring our schools, our grocery stores, and our churches will continue to be targets of violence and not the sanctuaries and safe places they should be." The court has steadily undermined gun laws, recognizing a right to keep guns at home for self-defense in 2008, and extending that right 2 years later. In the New York case, 2 men sued the state. Under the proper cause law, the men could secure unlimited permission to carry concealed guns in public only if they could demonstrate a special need for self-protection. Lawyers argued that carrying a firearm outside of the home was a fundamental constitutional right. It is not the same extraordinary action that requires an extraordinary demonstration of need. Civil rights and gun safety groups attempted to sway the court. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, argued that lifting controls on guns in public places would harm First Amendment rights such as assembly, association, and speech. Gun control advocates warned that scrapping the law could hit relations between the police and citizens because anyone in contact with law enforcement would be more likely to be legally armed. On Thursday, 23rd of June, the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, said, "The Supreme Court is setting us backwards in dealing with gun violence. This decision is not just reckless, it's reprehensible." Kathy Hochul also said she was prepared to call the legislature back into session to deal with this. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, said she would not be deterred from standing up to the gun lobby and their repeated efforts to endanger New Yorkers. A leading representative of the gun lobby, Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association, NRA, joined Republicans celebrating a watershed win and said, "The right to self-defense and to defend your family and loved ones should not end at your home." But Keechan Sewell, the New York City Police Commissioner, warned gun owners, "If you carry a gun illegally in New York City, you will be arrested. Nothing changes today." Rana Epting of Move On said, "It is hard to imagine a Supreme Court more out of touch with the people. Common sense policies to reduce gun violence are supported by 9 out of 10 Americans. This court is now nothing more than the political arm of the most extreme elements of the Republican Party." Pointing to Mitch McConnell's unprecedented denial of even a hearing to Barack Obama's third nominee, Merrick Garland, now Attorney General, and the confirmation of 3 justices under Donald Trump, Rana Epting said, "Republicans stole seats and packed this court to enact what voters have repeatedly rejected at the ballot box. It is far past time we expand the court, reform it, and restore balance to our judicial system."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Ilmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much, Jazakallah.
as everybody knows, that teenage is a very crucial stage, and when parents are dealing with the teenagers, does father and mother have a different role when dealing with teenagers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is a very important question regarding the differences between a father and a mother. And I guess this discussion is very general as well. It can be approached in a very general way. When it comes to the discussion of upbringing and tarbiyah, we talk about how a role of a father in a family and the role of a mother in a family is in some ways similar, in some other ways it's different.
Okay.
And there are ways that there are things that the father does that mother doesn't, and vice versa. I'd like to discuss this very briefly. Obviously, we can mention many things. Inshallah, I'll just touch upon a few of them, specifically related to this kind of later age of a child's life, teenagers, basically.
Okay.
But before I do that, let me mention a very general kind of discussion on the type of parenting that we can have. And based on that, inshallah, I'll move on to the differences between a father and a mother, which is what the question is about.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at type of parenting, you can say that there's kind of three types of parenting, generally, you could say. One of them is the kind of parenting where the expectations are very low.
Okay.
And the giving is also very low. So both what's coming in, what's coming out, both of them are very low. They're kind of not caring parents, basically. So those kind of parents who send their kids to school and don't really care what's happening in school.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon, the kids are mainly just watching TV and doing their own things. What the parents expect from their children is very low.
Okay.
They don't really expect too much from the children. As long as they're well fed and they're happy children generally, they're not complaining too much, and they're not asking for too much money from their pocket. They're happy parents, basically, in terms of their children. And on the other side as well, children are not giving too much as well, because the expectation from the parents is very low.
Mm-hmm.
Youth are not really giving in too much. And they're not going to be growing or interacting or working so much on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So this is low expectation, low giving. The second type is where you have dictatorship kind of parents, where the expectation is very high.
Okay.
And at the same time, the expectation is very high. The response from the children is also going to be very low.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because with the expectations that are higher than the capacity of the child, there's also very little room for giving in, very little room for understanding the child's need.
All right.
So you find these kind of parents, basically, they want their children to have 20 out of 20 in school in every single class of them, or to have A stars everywhere. They expect them to, the child to come back from school and be reading the Quran and reading 3-4 books at a time, and also doing a lot of exercise, also cleaning up their room and cleaning up the whole house as well, and praying on time and sleeping on time. And they've got a whole schedule for their child.
What they expect from a child.
They expect a huge amount of things from a child, not giving in so much. Not understanding the needs of the child.
I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIP English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about the role of father and mother in the teenager's life. Yes, brother, you were saying that they are dictator kind of parents who expect a lot from their children and they're not giving in much input.
What we need to do and understand is that a true and a very balanced approach is what we need to kind of have in our family, where the expectations must be reasonable expectations based on the reality of the situation, of the child's needs, the child's abilities and potential. At the same time, there's also always room for flexibility. And once you understand this, you realize that when we're dealing with teenagers, you have clear expectations and you also have clear red lines. And you build a bridge based on respect and love to make sure that whilst the expectations are met and whilst the clear lines, the clear red lines basically are maintained, okay, there's also this atmosphere of very strong love, very strong respect, basically. And this requires both parents to be in synchrony with this. So mm-hmm. both father and mother ensure that they expect from the child an amount that is according to the child's needs and capacity and potential.
True.
At the same time, they've cleared out those expectations. They've made sure that the child knows about these expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And also they've cleared out the red lines as well, that this is the thing we don't accept in this house, for example. This is the kind of lines we won't cross. So I expect you to kind of stay in these boundaries. So
right.
Just to give an example, for example, being out of the house after 10 p.m., for example.
Yes.
Right? Or
no screen time after 9 p.m.
For example. I mean, these are just running examples to show that the child also knows their clear red lines.
Yeah.
As much as we can, we make red lines based on the Sharia. Whatever is haram is obviously the main red line that we need to have. And then things that are harmful or things that are related to social etiquettes, etc.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the difference between a father and mother. A mother, one of the places where it manifests a lot is in how we deal with a child in relation to these rules and regulations or these expectations and the red lines. But as I mentioned, firstly, that both the parents are in synchrony with this. So they should have talked with each other. And the child should also know that both mom and dad are aware of this expectation. And they're aware of the red lines as well. And that is how the family works.
Mm-hmm.
However, the side that will be putting out these expectations or putting out these red lines and ensuring that this happens is the role of the father.
All right.
The father plays the role of that strength, that authority, that final
power.
Final the power or the final decision making basically mm-hmm. rests with the father. And in a stable, in a very balanced Islamic family, this is very clear.
Okay.
The role of the father is the father says which are the red lines. The father makes those red lines and ensures that the family kind of has this red lines in place.
Okay. What else? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the roles of parents, a father and a mother, in the life of a teenager. Brother, you said that the role of a father should be specified. It should be clear that father is the main authority, the main decision maker of the family.
And at the same time, as you mentioned, the father's role is this strength and the final decision, basically. On the other side, the mother's role is to kind of play the loving, the gentleness, the place where
Sober.
There is more softness, basically.
Okay.
Right? That covers the aspect of the kind of emotions.
Yeah.
Right. Now, let me make this very, very clear. And I don't want any misunderstanding to happen over here. We're not saying that father plays a ruthless, violent role and the mother plays a very emotional, kind of rule. No, that's not what we're saying.
Okay.
The father also has to show a lot of love, has to show a lot of kindness, a lot of gentleness. And at the same time, the mother has to also be very firm and very stable.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be the case that children should go to their mom to break all the rules, basically.
Yes.
That never happens, right? The point is not this. The point is that the kind of aspect and the kind of attitude and the kind of role is defined in a family. And this is seen by the children. They see that this is what happens. But they also get the same amount of love from the dad. And at the same time, they don't break rules because mom said so or because mom will allow to rules break. Mom doesn't allow the rules to be broken. But mom allows that emotional aspect to be covered. If there's a need for an explanation, for example, there's a need for a shoulder to cry on, you usually go to your mom, for example.
Yes.
Again, I emphasize, it doesn't mean you don't go to your dad, right? The kind of the roles are naturally formed like this. And you find that this is the kind of very stable house that will bring about very confident children. One of the aspects and one of the, I would say, the challenges that we face today is that when these roles are mixed up,
you
find that a child, when he enters teenagers, they are of very weak personalities.
They're not confident.
They're not confident. They don't have self-esteem. They don't know where they stand. They don't know how to express their personalities. And one reason, I'm not saying the only reason, but one of the reasons is because at home, there's an imbalance. There's massive decisions and authority that the mother takes when she's not supposed to. And at the opposite side, the father plays no role in the family, completely quiet figure within the family. This leads to...
dominated by a female.
Exactly. And this leads to a boy, for example, who's growing up to be very
weak
in his personality.
Okay.
Right? Unable to make decisions, unable to stand on their feet, be independent, unable to aim for high things, be very low in confidence. At the same time, as girls lacking this need for that support from a manly figure, not having the father's support and the father's love and respect for a daughter leads to them also being very weak of character. So this is a very important point that we need to take care and keep in mind when dealing with children.
Okay. So, these were very important things that parents need to keep into consideration while they are dealing with teenagers. You said that if a woman is dominant at home and father has no authority, both whether it's a boy or a girl who are in their teens, they will develop into weak personalities, and parents definitely need to take care of that. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi aman Allah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.